The new novel, The Great Believers, is one of the first to be about the AIDS epidemic in the city of Chicago, which was and is the third largest city in America. A Chicago native, the author Rebecca Mackay digs deep into the history and heart of how AIDS affected her hometown and turns her research into a poignant novel that feels almost too real to be fiction. In the new book, Mackay weaves together 1980s Chicago and contemporary Paris to tell a story of survivors who were forever affected by the AIDS crisis. Rebecca Mackay is the author of The Borrower and The 100-Year House. Again, the name of the new book is The Great Believers, and we welcome Rebecca Mackay to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
A beautiful novel about friendship and redemption in the face of tragedy. This takes place in the 1980s, Chicago, Paris. Tell us how this particular novel came about.
I actually was really intrigued by some parallels that I was discovering between World War I era Paris and 1980s Chicago, specifically the way that in both cases you have a generation that of, you know, young people who have come to a big city. It's kind of a mecca for them. I'm thinking of the artists who came to, you know, Paris before World War I, and of course the LGBTQ community coming to a place like Chicago in the 80s, finding each other, finding chosen family, and then in both cases, a war, literal or figurative, ripping through and taking the lives of many, many young men. And then these same generations, the survivors, trying to pick themselves up and continue on. So those are both threads in the book, and then I also have a modern-day section that's in Paris as well.
So this idea of comparison, it seems as though you wanted to compare in some way.
In some way, yeah. Now, the book is, we only hear about 1920s Paris. We don't go there in the book. It's something that... My main character is this guy, Yale Tishman, and he's the development director for a small art gallery at Northwestern University. And there's a woman who'd been an artist model in Paris back in the 20s, and she's talking to him a lot because she's donating some art that she has left over from that time. And she really is one of the only people who understands what he's going through, because this happened to her too. As the virus circles closer and closer to Yale, as he loses people close to him, she's one of the people who can understand him and can tell him about her experiences. The point of the book is not the comparison, but it was one of the sparks that started it. It certainly goes far away from there in my eventual intentions.
When you look at the AIDS crisis and how it affects Chicago, obviously you're Chicago native, so you wanted to see how it impacted your hometown. But it goes deeper than that, though.
Yeah, for sure. I discovered as I started to research that the Chicago narrative of the crest of the AIDS epidemic in America is vastly underrepresented. When you look at, the big films, the big, nonfiction books,
right.
Even a lot of art that's out there, it really tends to be about New York and San Francisco.
Right.
And for good reason, those were the epicenters. But Chicago is the third biggest city in America with a really sizable gay population, and it hit very hard in Chicago. And I was kind of appalled that there wasn't, I set out thinking that there would be multiple nonfiction books giving the overview of what happened, and there is not one.
So tell us about the story itself in The Great Believers and who these great believers are.
Yeah, it's funny, that title comes from an F. Scott Fitzgerald essay, which I then use a longer portion of as the novel's epigraph, and he's talking about that lost generation. He's talking about that, World War I generation. But that title, The Great Believers, became sort of my North Star as I was writing. I found it very early and really wanted to justify using a title that optimistic on a novel about a topic this heavy. I think for one thing, it kept my novel from, descending into just utter bleakness, because it kept me asking, what do these people believe in against all odds? What hopes do they cling to What beliefs do they lose, but what are they able to sustain in the midst of all this? And a lot of that, you know, the answers have a lot to do with friendship and with chosen family.
Of course, there are parallels to be made to what is happening in 1980, what's happening now, especially when it comes to healthcare. And it's impossible to read the novel and to read your take of the state of healthcare during the AIDS crisis and what we're going through now.
Right. Yeah. Well, for one thing, but just putting the parallels aside, AIDS is still very much an issue in America and globally. There are 37 million people around the world living with HIV. Only quote unquote 1.1 million of those are in America, but there are, you know, about a million people dying of AIDS every year globally. And, you know, this is at a time when, you know, at the end of 2017, Trump fires all the remaining members of the HIV AIDS Advisor Council. In that budget, which we don't really know what's even in the budget, but the, part of the proposal was to a $1 billion cut in global AIDS spending prevention. So this is still very much, you know, now. It's not just parallels. It's still happening. But then beyond that, you know, broadening it a bit, there are always going to be marginalized communities that are denied access to healthcare for what might seem like fiscal reasons, but that honestly, ultimately, often come down to prejudice.
That's right. I mean, you make this point, but and it comes out very loud and clear in the book. But if you look at the disbanding of the HIV AIDS Advisory Council, that isn't just a cost saving measure. It's much more insidious than that, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no. If this were a million Americans who had, you know, Legionnaires' disease, there's no way that you'd disband
right.
that organization.
So it's homophobia, it's racism, and it is a feeling that those lives are disposable, which we are learning seems to be the case when it comes to immigration as well.
That's the thing. Yeah, this is, you know, it's funny because, you know, the book came out on Tuesday, which was right when, you know, everyone was just, I think, the most upset, myself included, about what was coming out about these, you know, I'm going to call them concentration camps because that's what they are. And it felt like, you know, how I'm supposed to go out there and promote this book that I wrote now. But, you know, when I thought about it and I was looking at this photo that I've had as my my screensaver and my wallpaper on my laptop as I wrote this book for several years now. And this picture is of these five men sitting there at a candlelight vigil at night. And I know, you know, through my research who these men were, there's one survivor from this picture, and all the things they fought for. And, you know, what I posted to my friends that morning, you know, on social media, I put that picture out there, and I said, you know, the thing is, like, we are always going to be fighting these fights, and, you know, genocide doesn't always come in swinging a machete. There are genocides of neglect. There are genocides of antipathy. And, you know, we're going to be conscripted into those battles whether we'd like to be or not. And that you know, that's where we get into the parallels. These things are, no matter when you live, no matter what country you live in, people with power are going to abuse that power. And they're going to take it out against the most, you know, the most helpless citizens among us.
And with all of that said, this is a hopeful novel.
Yeah, it is. I have to, you know, I think part of it is, that was why it was important for me to be jumping forward 30 years. You know, we have every other section is in 2015. And getting the long view on things, it's not that, gosh, the ending is that everything turns out okay and everyone survives. That's certainly not the novel that I wrote. But that there are ways to put your life back together. There are ways to move on. And there are ways to fight. And I feel like I learned in my research by interviewing these people that I interviewed, I learned so much about what it means to fight and the ways that we can fight even when we're exhausted and even when, you know, whether we have everything to lose or we have nothing left to lose, we can still fight.
The name of the novel is The Great Believers. It is published by Viking. Rebecca Mackay, I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure. Best of luck with the novel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Great Believers. It is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.